Hello, this is Karen from San Francisco.
And this is Alex from Los Angeles. Welcome to Movies That Shaped Us, a journey of self-discovery through a shared love of film. We're two longtime friends who grew up on opposite ends of the globe with very different backgrounds. We were both shaped and are still being shaped by the movies we see and love. And each episode, we'll cover a topic around important people, places, events, and moments in our lives and explore it through three of our favorite movies. And we really hope these movies and topics are fun and revelatory to you, just like they've been to us. So Karan, why don't you tell our listeners what we're talking about today?
All right. So we are sort of in the middle of summer. So we figured it'll be good to have an episode about that. So yeah, our topic today is movies that shaped our feeling of summertime.
Yeah.
So I guess maybe I can start with what are my feelings about summer without giving away too much about my list.
Uh-huh.
I'll just come out of the gate, right off the gate, and just say that I'm not a big summer person per se, because I'm, yes, I'm
hot that, take
hot
and
take,
not, exactly. And not just hot because the summer is hot.
Right.
That is a hot take.
I mean, it's fine. You know, it's not like I'm like depressed or whatever, unhappy about. No, it's still pretty good. Like I don't really put that much emphasis on seasons per se. You know, it's all is fine pretty much. At the same time, I'm not a big beach person. I don't enjoy super hot weather, even though I grew up in a hot country. Maybe that's the reason why. Because for me, good days were overcast days. So it's sort of been in my head since the beginning of time.
Oh, okay.
And
that makes sense.
So you'll see my list sort of gets into those complicated feelings about summer. Uh-huh. And that's sort of how I put my list together. How about you?
Oh, cool. Well, like for me, it's the opposite in a way.
I know.
Like it's my favorite season, and mainly due to the weather. So because I grew up in the East Coast of the U.S. where there were very distinct seasons, it got colder in the winter. The spring was kind of wet, and I really just enjoyed the sun and the better weather, though. Sometimes, yeah, it would get too hot and humid, but it was always my favorite season. Also because, you know, growing up, that was when you weren't in school, which was fun. Mm-hmm. You know, I always associated it with, hanging out with my family a lot. We had a club that we were a member of. We could go to the pool and hang out there. We'd go on family vacations, a lot of trips to a beach. Was our big family vacation. I do love the beach and the sand and the waves and all that kind of, I love the ocean and being in the water. And I always associated those things with the summer because you couldn't go into the water in Massachusetts in the fall. You know, maybe a reason why I moved to LA, because it's kind of summer all the time, time here. So yeah, this is interesting then that we have sort of different, because of our backgrounds. I think you're right. Like you grew up in a place where it's probably just oppressively hot all the time that you have, you know, not the best association with summer. And, you know, I definitely is my favorite season. So be fun to talk through this.
Yep. All right. So what is your number three?
So my number three film that shaped my view of summer is The Great Outdoors, a film from 1988. This is directed by Howard Deutsch and written by John Hughes, starring John Candy, Dan Aykroyd, and Annette Bening. And the IMDb plot summary is a Chicago man and his family go camping with his obnoxious brother-in-law. And the reason why this is on my list, not only because I really enjoy the movie, but like I mentioned at the beginning, summer for me, especially growing up, was always around family vacations. So every year our family would go down to a beach house in Delaware and with my mom's side of the family. So I'd see my cousins. We'd spend 2 weeks, which is, you know, a long period of time there just all together as a family in this house. I think what this movie does is really speaks to a lot of what it means to be on a family vacation, not only with your immediate family, your brothers and sisters and parents, but with your extended family. Because in this film, like the plot summary notes, you know, it's an uncle coming, or it's two sisters actually that are the John Candy's wife's sisters, Annette Bening, who has a husband, Dan Aykroyd, and they're coming to join the family at this beach house. So, you know, I think it just shows a lot about, you know, meeting up with your extended family. Yeah, you have fun. You do a lot of things together in this film, you know, fishing, boating, going out to eat, cooking at home, eating together as extended family. These are all things that you did. But two, like, you know, there's some drama that always comes up as well. You know, you're in a house confined there with family members who, you know, you've known all your life, and definitely like the drama can come out a little bit too. So you get to see that, you know, interesting things with relationships of, you know, maybe your uncle, you uncles or parents, or this, you know, stuff sort of comes out, which this movie obviously deals a lot with some past issues between the different sisters, that you know, little fights can come up that maybe have been happening throughout your entire life. So this is definitely something that, you know, I found happened a lot in these vacations. Also tend to, you know, these folks in this movie, you know, they're not super wealthy. So the house isn't really nice. And, you know, I did not grow up in a super wealthy family either. So, you know, the house we stayed in was not super, like, didn't have air conditioning. I slept out on a porch basically, cause there was not a lot of room for everyone who was there. And the, you know, there was screen windows, but there was always holes in them. So like mosquitoes would get in, and, you know, so it's not going to be perfect, but you're there with family still having a good time. And I think this movie captures that really well. It's not like they're staying in some palatial cabin. I mean, in the beginning, they get in there and there's like mess all over the place and the, you know, trash everywhere. So I thought that was great representation of that. So yeah, I mean, this movie really just reminds me of a lot of those vacations, which to me were all about summer. And look, the movie is very funny too. I think it's John Candy does a great job. Dan Aykroyd, just absolutely hilarious performance. Annette Bening's first film. And I think she does a great job in it.
I did not know that.
Yeah, her very first movie.
Weird laughs.
Oh, I was just going to say her laugh, how she laughs at her husband.
The only thing she has to do in the movie, but she's good at it.
She's so good at that. So yeah, and the ending, I just love too, where they're doing any movie that ends on a dance sequence over the credits. And this is a classic, you know, they dance a land of a thousand dances and they're all there again, showing just like families can have fun and dance together, which is again, something that we used to do a lot when we got together with family to play music and dance. And, you know, so yeah, it's a great film. I still think it holds up really well. Definitely reminds me of summer.
Yeah, that last scene is pretty fun. Yes, interesting. As I was watching the movie, I knew why you had picked it, because I imagined that you had similar experiences. Mm-hmm. I didn't, because with my dad being in the army, we were always posted away somewhere. So for the summer holidays, we usually came back to Delhi, where my grandparents and my aunts were there. And I was the only child for the longest time until my sister came along. So we were the only two kids. We didn't have any cousins or anybody.
Oh, okay.
Or, you know, and then I have one other cousin in the family who is like 11 years younger to me. So my entire childhood was basically just us. So, and coming back to Delhi was sort of coming back home in a way, because it was always,
right,
you know, our roots, because that's where our grandparents and aunts were at. So I never really had this experience of kind of going to another place with like other relatives and their kids, because there weren't any. So, but I appreciate that experience. And I think that's probably has something to do with my awkward feelings about, you know, housing with like people that I don't know about that much, even into my adulthood. Like I have to think a little bit, you know, and prepare myself for trips with other people in like a different house. I have to think about, okay, how's the bathroom going to work? How's this going to work? Because I'm not used to that at all. You know, just didn't grow up with it. But I had a fun time watching the movie. I love everybody in the movie. The movie is not great.
No.
Say that, which, you know, doesn't have to be, because I'm a big John Hughes fan and I don't think this is a strong John Hughes film. I'm a big John Candy fan as well. Dan Aykroyd, like, I love everybody involved in the movie, but the movie is not, it could have been much better. I just think, because it sort of becomes very, very predictable. Everything that John Candy starts, you know, the moment he's starting it, this is not going to go well.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And it's one of the most weirdly edited movies where you would see something and then suddenly the twins will appear in the rain, and then something else will appear. You it's sort of like weirdly put together. I'm like, oh, they were in the same car. Oh, they were there too. It's just so like, I had so many of these moments of kind of falling off my chair. Oh, what just happened? Oh, what just happened? So there's a lot of that. The romance between the two kids is the most
so boring.
Expedited romance. I'm like, you just met and you're like making out like crazy. Is this?
Well, yeah, I think that is the worst, the part of the movie that always dragged. But there is this concept, and you know, I never lived this, so I can't speak to this personally, of, you know, the summer romance. You're away at camp and you meet someone, sure. you have to rush it because they're leaving in 2 weeks. Yeah. But yeah, that is definitely the most boring part of the film.
Oh my
gosh. Did not connect with it. So annoying every time that
very plot annoying. Came to the Those screen. Kids are very cute though.
Yeah.
That's sort of it. But I was like, I don't know what is happening there. So yeah, I mean, fun movie, but I given everything I know about John Hughes, I just felt this movie could have been a lot better. But I still had a good time watching it.
Yeah, I think this movie, there's several movies that are sort of like this, where overall the movie is okay, but there's a couple scenes that are so good, it kind of like elevates the rest of the movie. And maybe too, because the most I watched this film was mainly just on TV. It would be on, you know, TNT or TBS all the time. And you pick up halfway through and maybe you watch for 20 minutes and see all the funny bits. Oh, the old 96er, or, you know, the scene that's really funny with the bat and Dan Aykroyd. And then you kind of stop watching it. So when you sit down and watch it as a whole, you're like, yeah, overall, this movie is not great. But a couple of those scenes are so classic that it kind of elevates film a little bit. But I'm also not the biggest John Hughes fan. This is actually one of the movies I like of his more, just because, again, films don't usually resonate with you too much. But yeah, I'm glad you watched it. And hopefully it gave you a sense of what it was like to go on these kind of family vacations.
True.
You didn't experience that in your own childhood. So
that part definitely came through, and living in a house, living in the wilderness, and, you know, trying out different things, like that part definitely came through. But yeah, the whole eating of the steak situation, I was like, this.
Oh, I love that scene.
I know.
It's so funny.
And I'm like, don't do this to him. Yeah. Don't do this to him. It's horrible. okay, so my number three.
Yeah, let's do it. What's your number three?
Okay, so my number three, I guess we are in John Hughes territory today, is Ferris Bueller's Day Out. This is a movie from 1986 starring Matthew Broderick, Alan Ruck, Mia Sara, and a quick log line: a high school wise guy is determined to have a day off from school despite what the principal thinks of that. I put this movie on my list despite some negative feelings about summer, which I talked about and which we will get into as my list progresses. Uh-huh. This movie sort of represents kind of the freedom, fun aspect of summer, where you don't have many obligations, you don't have to go to school, and it's sort of this feeling of endless possibilities. Anything can happen, you can meet new people, you can go on big adventures, and silly things would happen and fun things would happen. It's also a great friendship movie. And I associate friendship a lot with summer, because that's the time where you get to hang out with your friends a little bit more off the leash, because you're sort of out and about, you know, entire day has passed where you've just been with your friends and then you're coming back home to see your parents. So I remember those days from my summer and sort of growing up. So that's what this movie represents to me. But as a movie, like, I think this is one of John Hughes's best. It's so sharp and entertaining and funny, and it has some grounding to it. Like, these people feel like real people, you know, that they're not just caricatures. And that's sometimes what I feel like John Hughes movies can get into. Like the movie we just talked about, Great Outdoors, like, everybody's an archetype in a way, you know, versus this movie, all three main characters, they feel like real people. You're invested in them and their journey.
Yep.
This is a classic John Hughes thing in terms of the specificity of the place is so great. Like, you know where these people are at, and all the set pieces, I think, in this movie really work with those specific details, like the car, the parade, the contraptions in his bedroom to, you know, make people fake his presence and what have you. Like, all of that really works, as because they all set pieces, just like the steak, which doesn't work in my mind, versus here, all these set pieces actually work because they are grounded in something real. And there's like a true emotionality to these people. There's something poignant about how the movie develops and what people learn and who's actually with whom. I won't spoil the movie for anybody who hasn't seen it, because it's kind of becomes a bit of a triangle of sorts as the movie progresses. So I don't know. I've always enjoyed this movie. I've watched it a few times. Didn't watch it growing up for sure. I think I watched it the first time maybe 10 years ago.
Oh, okay.
But it's been on my kind of fun comfort movie list, if you will. And this represents the best things about summer. And the last thing I would say is I was in Chicago once for summer, actually right after grad school. And I got to kind of experience Chicago in that time. And yeah, there were some days that were a little bit hot and humid, but for the most part, I mean, Chicago just sort of lights up, you know, in that time. It's such a beautiful city. And so this is a good homage to that too.
Cool. Yeah. Nice. This is a film that I did see on and off growing up. It actually wasn't one of my favorites. A lot of kids my age, this was like, oh, they love this movie. And it never connected with me that well then. And it's interesting, like, the point I was making about Great Outdoors were like a couple scenes, but then they elevate the movie, which is kind of okay. In a weird way, I guess, for me, because mainly I would watch it in pieces. Like, the pieces weren't so great, but when you put it together as a whole, because, like, I hadn't seen this, you know, from opening to last post-credit sequence of him coming out and saying, like, are you still in the theater? Right. For, I mean, decades, probably. And I gotta say, I was, like, blown away by how amazing this movie is. And how groundbreaking it was on so many different levels. And I think you nailed one of them in terms of the kids are not archetypes, but I also felt the kids were real because they were not what typically would happen in movies, especially teen movies, is you know, the kids become ciphers for like adult behaviors because it's an adult writing the movie. You know, it's a, I don't know how old John Hughes was at the time, but he was definitely not a teenager. But these feel like actual teenagers with actual teenage problems,
that is John Hughes's, you know, brilliant gift. Everything is written for teenagers. He really had a pulse on who these people are, and that's what makes his movies so special. And I think this is a perfect example of that.
Oh, totally. Yeah, and the way that this movie, too, which came out, you're saying like 85, 86, something like that, right?
Yeah, 86.
86, yeah. So mid-80s, and I really do think this film, when I was watching it, especially this time, is the seed of the entire like 90s teen television shows, movies, where the kid is the main character, the adults represent authority, and the kid is fighting against his authority and wins in the end. Like, the adults in this movie are a total joke. Jeffrey Jones, incredible performance. But the movie, like, constantly, like, you know, makes fun of him, you know, has him getting hurt, and the kids end up winning, which is something that was a rarity when this movie came out. And then you turn to the 90s, every single movie is about kids, you know, kicking adults in the balls, and like, they win, like, oh, they're skipping school and they never get caught. And seeing this in this movie, and the breaking the fourth wall piece of Ferris talking to the audience, talking to his fellow kids, essentially, is something that was very new at the time too. I mean, I guess Dobie Gillis did that in the 60s, but in a film. And then I think this set a template where that fourth wall breaking concept was brought into so many kids shows in the 90s. Like Clarissa Explains It All is one example of a show that I watched that never would have been conceived of if it had not been for this movie. So that's really what I think surprised me the most watching this, is like, okay, I've seen Ferris, you know, I think it's fine. It never really connected with me very much. But on this watch, I just like, whoa, like, it just, maybe the perspective now of being older or something, it connected with me more. But yeah, the movie was fantastic. I think this is definitely a classic for a reason, and something that still would resonate with kids today. Like, it doesn't feel dated. It feels timeless. No,
it feels so fresh.
So timeless and fresh. And due to the performances, I mean, Matthew Broderick's amazing. Like I said, Jeffrey Jones is great. Charlie Sheen is great. Jennifer Grey. Like, it's just across the board great. So if any folks haven't seen this out there yet, definitely watch it. It does feel like it was made yesterday.
I know.
In the best possible way. But yeah, I think you're right about the summer too, the feeling of hanging out with your friends, not being in school, being kind of on your own. There's a little bit of that freedom that Ferris is obviously feeling because he's skipping school. Then in the summer, you know, unless you're in a camp or a summer school or some kind of program, which I never did as a kid, I was never in a camp or anything like that, that I definitely felt in the summer too, that sense of, oh, there's no teachers around to tell me what to do anymore. This is great. I'm going to hang out with my friends.
Right. Exactly. And I don't know, maybe I took a note from this movie, but, or maybe I just had this in me for a while, but I highly recommend, you know, in life, taking a day when you can for personal care. Mm-hmm. And this is not just a, you know, pandemic thing, but I've sort of had this in my mind, and I've implemented it over and over again, that whatever brings you joy, take a day in the middle of the week if you can, you know, and get out and do something that brings you joy. And I think this movie really exemplifies that, obviously in a heightened way, but I do believe in that philosophy, actually.
That's a great point. Actually, I was on Twitter yesterday, and I saw a sticker that was for sale, which was use all your sick days. And that was a concept I never really thought of it, because in California, where both of us live, or at least in the companies that I've worked at, your sick days expire every year. So you get maybe 2 weeks of sick time. If you don't use it, you just get 2 weeks again next year. And it's like, that's, you know, state mandated days where you can just not be at work. And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to be sick is sort of the point, I think, of what that sticker was trying to say. Use that time for your own, you know, just personal kind of unplugging, just take a walk, go to the, you know, the beach. I mean, maybe you wouldn't want to go to the beach, Karan, but I would go to the beach. But yeah, no, that's a great message of this movie in a way. It's like, bunk off. Don't, you know, take off every so often. Life is short, you know, take your sick days, even if you're not sick, because that's, you know, it leads to a better life. And it definitely, I think, improved for sure, you know, Ferris's life, but especially Cameron, his friend. I think he made a lot of big life realizations by not just being stuck in that constant, okay, you just go to school, you go to class, you don't really take a step back and think about, no, I want to, you know, take more control over my life. And he never would have done that if he had stayed in school. So skip school, kids.
Gosh, no. Do not listen to Alex.
Stay out of school. That is a lesson of this film.
Oh, no. All right. What is your number two?
So my number two film is 1998's The Mask of Zorro. So this is directed by Martin Campbell, starring Antonio Banderas, Anthony Hopkins, and Catherine Zeta-Jones. IMDb plot summary: a young thief seeking revenge for his brother's death is trained by the once great aging Zorro, who is pursuing his own vengeance. So the reason why I put this film on the list is that for me, one of the key things about the summer, especially growing up, were summer movies. I would be looking forward to them throughout the year. There was a special, I mean, I think nowadays this is sort of these movies can kind of come out any time of the year. There really is no concept of summer movies anymore. But when I was growing up in the 90s, there definitely was this time where, you know, between Memorial Day weekend and Labor Day weekend, there'd be all the big four quadrant, you know, popcorn blockbusters that were made to entertain every member of the family. So we would go out to the movies as a family a lot during the summer because there were movies that we all could agree to go see because they were made kind of for everyone. It wasn't just, oh, this is the adult drama or this is the animated film for kids. I mean, it was really that time. And I picked this movie in particular because I feel that it really just encapsulates a lot of what blockbuster four quadrant filmmaking was. It was a representation of that. There are a lot of other movies I could have picked. Independence Day, I think, falls in that category. Men in Black, all from this time period, late 90s. And maybe that's just because the age I was in. But
yeah.
So what, you know, what made this summer movie special, like I said, there's anticipation. So throughout the spring, there'd be all these specials. Oh, what summer movies are coming out? I'd always associate that with the summer. I get calendar, you know, get a calendar out, mark all the dates in the calendar of when all the movies are coming out, planning to go with what group of friends or, you know, my sisters would be interested in this. We go as a family to a couple movies every summer. And this movie, again, had kind of everything. It got the action, great, you know, classic story, a hero's journey. So it's nothing kind of complicated. It's very satisfying and makes you feel good just to, you know, consume something that is so classic. You got a little bit of romance, Catherine Zeta-Jones, not her first performance, but definitely star making performance there.
Incredible.
Just, and she burns off the screen with her, you know, the sexiness and the screen presence and, you know, which is actually another thing too, that I feel like is kind of missing from movies, that sense of sexiness. And it's just been so stripped out of movies nowadays. The back in the, you know, the 90s, you want a little bit of that in your summer blockbuster. Villain that is very clearly a villain, like he's, you know, he's the bad guy. There's, you know, there's nothing kind of complicated there, so it's very easy for young kids to follow it. Based on an IP, like people know who Zorro is. It was definitely around in the consciousness in here in the US, so it's something that you know, everyone can, you know what you're gonna getting before you get in there. And it's funny, like there's some funny quips and one-liners, and it's got a little something for everyone is what I'm trying to say, which is definitely something I associate with summer movies, and summer blockbusters were a very important part of my summer experience as a kid. So this movie represents a lot of films, but I felt this would be a fun one to put on the list.
Got it. Yeah, I was wondering why you have this on the list. Like, do you have a connection with Zorro? Were you in Mexico? And I was trying to kind of think on a thematic level, why is this movie on your list? So, okay, that explains
summer. It could have been Con Air. It could have been Independence Day. It could have been Godzilla, movie I didn't like, but I was looking forward to. So yeah, it's like the representation of summer movies, which is, I cannot separate my summer experience growing up from blockbusters.
Got it. Yeah, I'd never seen this movie before because I just assumed this was bad. I guess I was, you know, kind of a prickly moviegoer even as a teenager. I probably was. But I watched it a few weeks ago in preparation for this podcast, and I had a really good time. I was so impressed by how good this movie was. Super entertaining, tight story, brilliantly crafted, the special effects, action sequences of the horse and everything like, really holds true. The cast is great. Everybody. Two big observations that made me chuckle and smile and laugh. Yeah. Number one, Catherine Zeta-Jones, amidst all the trials and tribulations, not a blemish, not a speck of dirt on her face.
No. Yeah. Never, she's got to look good.
I mean, the town is burning down around her. Nothing. And oh, by the way, she's having this dialogue with the father, spoiler alert, her biological father.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then they lock him up, Anthony Hopkins, and then she comes later to kind of free him up. New outfit, new necklace. Right.
Of course.
You had to go back and change before you can free your dad up.
Yeah, see, this is the kind of stuff.
Out loud.
Yeah, this is the kind of stuff you get in these movies where it's like, that's what you want, though. You want to see her in different outfits. You don't want to see her look messy.
No.
That's why you're paying the, you know, the $5 to see Captain Zeta-Jones. Yeah.
Exactly. So great. And then number two, Anthony Hopkins. Oh, my goodness. So either he looks like a prissy gay pirate with the goatee and the long hair, laughable and hilarious. Tons of eye makeup, laughed out loud completely. I'm like, why are you in this movie to begin with?
Yeah.
And when he's not that and hair tied back, it looks like Susan B. Anthony. Also very hilarious. I mean, we were just laughing out loud. I'm like, why are you in this movie? Zeta-Jones at least sort of passes as somebody who's Latina. They've bronzed her up like crazy.
Yeah.
So, you know, I gave that a pass. But this one, I'm like, also, why are you speaking in a British accent?
I know. It's
we are
so
in
funny.
Mexico. What is happening? I don't know. It was very laughable, but in, you know, in like a sweet kind of a way.
It's like cheesy, you know, you kind of know what they're doing, but it's not, it doesn't get in the way of the story. It kind of elevates a little bit. And again, I think that's what these blockbuster popcorn cheesy movies do.
I would not say elevate, but yes, entertain.
Entertain. That's a better way to say it. And it makes you more entertained. Yeah, exactly. Hopkins is just like, what are you kind of doing in this? I actually don't remember
wrong.
At what point he came in. Cause this movie is directed by Martin Campbell, who's directed like GoldenEye and Casino Royale. Right. There's another of those three. Like he does know how to do a popcorn movie, action movie really well. But originally it was supposed to be Robert Rodriguez. And he's the one who brought in Banderas. Cause he was like, we have to have a Latino actor playing this role. Cause they were trying to get white actors in there, and maybe Anthony Hopkins was left over from the previous regime or something, but he's funny in this. He stands out, but in like an endearing way. But yeah, good observation. Oh, great score too. I want to shout out to James Horner, one of my favorite scores. I listen to this all the time, especially in the summer. Actually, I went at the beach for some reason. It's a score I put on, but I'm glad you liked it. I'm glad you liked the film.
It's really fun, great costumes, and the big, I don't know, villa or wherever they stay. I love that. Like the kind of the rusty red walls. That was pretty great. So, but yeah, Susan B. Anthony and Prissy Gay Pirate.
Love
I cannot get that out of my head.
Maybe that's where his pirate performance might've been where Johnny Depp got some Jack Sparrow from, maybe.
Maybe, yeah. And the black tights and the eye makeup, I mean, come through.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool. Yeah. So what is your number two movie that shaped your summer?
All right. So my number two is a little known movie called The Graduate from 1967, directed by the great Mike Nichols, starring Dustin Hoffman, Anne Bancroft, Catherine Ross. So I put this movie on my list because this movie kind of represents what I was touching on earlier, sort of the angst and sort of this feeling of way too much time on your hand feeling and what to do with myself feeling that summer brings. I'm not very good with that. I need some sense of boundary and structure. And I've become better with this as I've grown older for sure. But even now, if I have like 3 days off and I'm just sitting at home and doing, I don't know, tasks and projects and what have you, by the end of the third day, I will be as a messed up crazy person for sure. I don't know why that is. I need some sort of structure to my life. And this is what this movie represents to me. Also a little bit of kind of summer parties, you know, with people that you don't really know and you don't want to really hang out with them. And those earlier scenes of how he sort of shoved around and paraded around, you know, with the parents, friends and such. Mm-hmm. It sort of reminds me of that. There were lots of summer parties I remember growing up, you know, either through dad's army stuff or when we would be back in Delhi, we would be meeting, you know, other random relatives, like not my aunts and grandparents who are sort of the close family, but these are like second, third cousins who I have no real connection with. I hope they're not listening to this podcast, but if you are,
I hope they are. Yeah. Gosh. Shout out to them. It's a positive thing. Shout out. Yeah.
So it reminds me of that kind of a little bit, but then it also reminds me of, or my association with sort of, there's something seductive and hot about the summer too. You know, it sort of brings out repressed feelings or what have you that you may be harboring, and it brings those out and gives them some light, because there is that sense of freedom and anything is possible in the summertime. I have not had a Mrs. Robinson episode in my life
yet.
You know, putting that out there yet. Yeah, I guess now I would be playing Mrs.
That, Robinson. That was my implication. Yeah.
I think there's something about that. And then, you know, also this sense of FOMO that comes in a little bit, because there's so much to do in the summer, apparently. You know, people are always doing stuff, and people like me who are not big summer people, who often say no to stuff, but then are checking their feed out and just thinking about, oh shit, I probably should have said a yes to that thing, and now they're on the yacht or on the boat or whatever, and I'm just here watching, I don't know, Ingrid Bergman at, you know, 2 p.m. in the afternoon.
Yeah,
that's sort of sad. But then I think there's, it's those feelings that this movie represents for me. The movie, I mean, what can I say about The Graduate that hasn't been said? So, you know, I'll just keep it really brief. I mean, this is a masterpiece in every department.
Yep.
Watching it again this time, I've seen it many, many times before, but I don't think there is a movie that puts you in the point of view of its character as much as this movie does. Mm-hmm. You really feel every beat of anxiety and angst and horniness or what have you that comes with this character, which is incredible. And the one scene that really, I guess I'd never noticed that scene before, or maybe I did, but that really struck me was the first time he sees Mrs. Robinson naked, she flashes off her body.
Yeah.
I was so mesmerized by that. I don't know how I missed that scene earlier. I'm sure people are like vomiting hearing this, because there are probably essays and theses on that scene out there. But that's just the kind of stuff Mike Nichol does, you know? I mean, this to me is like the perfect blend of performance, writing, filmmaking flourishes that actually elevate everything. You know, you don't have to be making a science fiction epic to have filmmaking flourishes. You can have those in telling a human story, which is my favorite kind of movie anyway. Mm-hmm. So, and that's what this movie is. So yeah, The Graduate, number two.
Yeah, I mean, I'll echo everything you said just in terms of the film as a film. It's one of my favorite movies. Saw it in high school and has loved it ever since then. It's it's also, I think this movie could have come up at multiple of our past episodes in terms of different topics. Yeah. There's so many layers to this movie. I mean, I could have included it in a lot of different ones. So, you know, I just echo everything you said about this movie being a masterpiece. I mean, I think it's got one of the best endings of any movie that has ever made too. It just really, really hits me.
Totally.
And in terms of the summer thing, it's interesting that, like, cause this movie definitely is the theme of this Hoffman's character is directionless. He's getting all these pressures. He just graduated. What are you going to do next? What are you going to do next? And that you associated that angst with summer, whereas like for me it was sort of the opposite of like, this was the time, the summer, where I could not have those pressures anymore, because it's the summer, like let's just not think about anything else and just enjoy these 3 months. Because yeah, I get this whole movie is around like, what do you do with your life? And you know, he is directionless, then he falls in love, and his whole point is like, now he all of a sudden then he becomes activated, right? And he has a meaning to his life, and he's trying to pursue this girl, and then he gets her, and then he's still directionless.
Yeah,
which is just the brilliant thing about this film too, that it's like you can have a goal, even if you accomplish that goal, it doesn't necessarily solve this itch of like, well, what am I doing with my life? What is the point of all of this? Like, I think those things do never go away. Maybe it lessens at various points in your life, like you don't think about it as much, but I think that's part of what life is just exploring all those different reasons reasons for why we're here, what to do with the life. But yeah, in terms of filmmaking, like, you know, all the illusions of, or him floating in the water and That again, signaling the directionless. And another cut that's just one of my favorite edits in all of film, when he jumps onto the raft and then it just cuts to him jumping onto Mrs. Robinson in the bedroom. I see that. It's one of those things you know is coming, and then it just like blows my hair back every time, just how amazing that edit is. This movie is just so well done. All the POV shots too, you mentioned, puts you really in the mind of the character, especially when he's in the scuba suit. And you're seeing everyone sort of where he feels just disconnected from all these people trying to tell him what to do and talk to him, but he can't really hear them.
And claustrophobic.
You can't hear them either. And it's that claustrophobia of expectations just being put on you. It's just a fantastic film.
Yeah. It's a shame to even put it on a number two on any list, but you know, it's a specific topic.
No, sure.
On number two. But yeah, on the summer point, I think for me, it's been the opposite because there's so much time to think about things in the summer because there isn't much going on. And like I said, I don't do very well with just, you know, lollygagging and languishing. And this is why this always brings up, because usually summers are, you know, growing up, they were about, oh, you're going to go back to school. What happens then? You know, and you're preparing for that, or it's the time right before you go to grad school, or usually some big project or something else is going to kick up at work right after the summer. So I'm already thinking about that shit. I shouldn't be.
Yeah, you got to live in the moment.
Which is, you know, I have to remind myself to do that. So I think that's why this movie represents that. And And then sort of and I didn't say this earlier, but like, to me, the metaphor of the ending is a little bit also summary, where you have this great FOMO about what party to go to or what romance to have or whatever summary thing you want to be doing. But once you achieve them, you're still kind of empty in a way. And, you know, what was all this running around really even for? And it's okay. I mean, it's the summer. It doesn't have to mean much. And that's the point. But I think for me, it was always about when I put myself out there to seek these experiences, at the end of the day, I still had those same anxieties and same question marks about going back to the real life, which this movie also represents, of course, in a different way. But yeah. And then I guess the imagery of the movie, like you were saying, there's some, whenever I think of summer through movies, I always think of him kind of floating away on that pool. It's embedded in my head, you know, aimless, directionless, but it's still nice because the pool is great and it looks good and the sun is shining and the people who seemingly love you are around you. So it's sort of that dichotomy, if you will, of summer.
Yeah, it's like he's using the metaphor for water and the pool, kind of flipping it a little bit. Instead of being relaxing, it's sort of numbing. They've, you know, even in the last movie you discussed too, in Ferris, I believe there's a Graduate reference to the pool scene. Rushmore references that. I mean, it's a famous metaphor for sort of being lost and a little aimless. And, you know, again, I think this just speaks to the power of this movie that decades later, it's still a reference that if you play some Simon and Garfunkel and see someone floating in a pool, they're like, oh, that's The Graduate. Like that is how, like, Mike Nichols is just a visual filmmaker, one of my favorites, and this movie I think just shows that in terms of how those, some of those shots, and two, the driving sequences, some of the my favorite scenes too, when he's driving up to San Francisco and they're just playing that Simon and Garfunkel, and the way that he you know, just captures the hills of like Northern California, and you're just feeling what the character's going through, is just some of my favorite sequences of the movie too. And there's a lot of those allusions in other films, even up to this point now, of, you know, a character sort of kind of a little bit lost and driving as a metaphor, using a music, a soundtrack behind is, yeah, just fantastic.
All right. What's your number one?
So my number one film, actually sharing two actors that were in The Graduate, were actually in this film. My film is Jaws from 1975, starring or directed by Steven Spielberg, starring Roy Schneider, Robert Shaw, Richard Dreyfuss, who had a tiny uncredited cameo in The Graduate as one of the roommates. And then Mrs. Robinson's husband is the mayor from Jaws, one of the more famous villains in history of film. So IMDb plot summary. When a killer shark unleashes chaos on a beach community off Long Island, it's up to a local sheriff, a marine biologist, and an old seafarer to hunt the beast down. So this film, to me, had to be number one. It's a movie I you would watch every summer growing up around 4th of July. The movie takes place around the 4th of July weekend. Similar to my, it kind of combines in a way, like my last two choices into a perfect encapsulation of it. There is the vacation element, people coming to this island to go on a vacation, beach vacation, something I always associated with the summer that my family would do all the time. All the, you know, the elements of, again, like 4th of July, like I mentioned, the key holiday of the summer that I would always look forward to, for, you know, the reason of usually go to the beach or have fun, but it is also, you know, maybe the prototype for the, I don't want to say the modern blockbuster, because I think we've actually moved beyond what the impact of what Jaws had done, but at least on me growing up, like movies like Zorro that I mentioned and some of those other films too, definitely owe its DNA to what Steven Spielberg did in this film, in terms of giving you the humor, giving you the action, giving you the suspense, all the different parts, maybe not the sexiness, though, you know, Robert Shaw is pretty sexy as that seafaring sailor guy in a certain way. So maybe he does the Captain Zeta-Jones part in this.
I would say Schneider.
Really? Over Dreyfus, even? Okay, Schneider. Yeah. Okay,
We'll get into it.
Dreyfus. Okay. I would pick Robert Shaw as the sexy old seafaring guy, but maybe that's just my personal taste. but yeah, again, iconography is all there, and then the roller coaster ride of the summer, what I associate with summer blockbusters. So I'd watch this movie every year growing up on 4th of July. And to me, this is the summer movie. If I were to pick one that I feel like every time I see Jaws, I'm like, oh, summer's coming up, I got to watch Jaws.
That's awesome. Yeah. So funnily enough, I had never seen this movie from beginning to end until.
Interesting.
Which is kind of, you know, silly and maybe even shameful to admit, because it's such an iconic film, but I'm obviously familiar with it. And, you know, like you, and from the other movies we talked about, I'd seen images of this movie and scenes of this movie, which are practically memes at this point. So It was sort of interesting to kind of go back and watch a movie that is so memeified and so part of our culture. Mm-hmm. And I also made the mistake of actually watching it on a smaller screen as opposed to my big screen. So I think I have to correct that a little bit, because I think the experience was a little bit different. But yeah, I mean, what can I say more about Jaws? Like, it's obviously incredible. And I know a lot about the backstory of how Spielberg made it and the filming of this movie and how cheaply it was done. And the fact that this movie is so elevated for what little money and effects and what have you that they had access to. It's kind of mind-boggling what they were able to achieve. The thing that I was struck with, a few things. One, I thought the earlier part of the movie, and this is clearly my own sort of thing that I leaned towards, was even stronger than the back half of what is happening, how the town is reacting. And yes, the mayor is, you know, the quote unquote villain, but it was very humanizing, you know?
Totally.
There's greed, but there's also, you know, interest of the small business owners, and this is sort of their big weekend, and there's resistance and hesitation. It sort of reminded me a lot of when COVID was happening, you know, like how different people react to, you know, a massive disaster that you don't really have an understanding of, and you are going to get different kinds of reactions, and I think that's okay, actually. You know, you can't just get on your high horse no matter what side you might be. You have to find a way to argue and have a dialogue about it, which you see that happen, you know. And then I thought the scenes with the boys, especially that table scene of the boy mimicking the father, so sweet. You know, I kind of teared up a little bit just watching that. The few glances that Roy Schneider and his wife share, even though she doesn't have much to do, sort of prototypical movie wife, but the few glances that they share when he's leaving and such, you see that this relationship is lived in, that
there's
something real about that, which is, you know, the mastery of Spielberg, and, you know, kudos to these actors. So I don't know, I found that first part of the movie way more compelling. It sort of drags and drifts, and I feel even weird saying this about a movie like Jaws, and maybe this is because I watched it on a small screen, but I found myself distracted when we were sort of on the wild goose chase of finding the shark. But you know, and of course it's John Williams, great score. Can't give him any notes, but I will say this, that I prefer movies when the score is sort of, you know, held back, and this movie, The theme, of course, is iconic. I wish we had just left it to that. And maybe this is a summer blockbuster thing that every second of the movie has to be scored. Mm-hmm. And I found it quite distracting, to be honest, when little victories would happen, when the battles are out. Now the music is theme park music.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
And I'm like, oh gosh, what is happening? So this is just my thing. I felt similarly about Crusade as well, our Indiana Jones movie. Every single second is scored.
Yeah.
Just not my thing. I can sort of then, you know what? I start to see the orchestra room. I can see the violinist and I'm not watching the movie. That's what happens to my brain when that happens. So it pulls me out, but I get it. It's a summer movie. The point is to have fun. I can only imagine if you were sitting in a big theater and that music was playing and that's how you first saw it. It's going to be so thrilling and so, you know, amazing. So I get that. But, you know, watching it now like this, that sort of was my experience. But obviously, when it comes to summer movies, everything you said, you know, I agree, but this is...
Yeah, that's an interesting note on the score. I mean, I think John Williams and this film and then Star Wars and Superman, like those three scores brought back the full orchestral, always music, noticeable
Not
themes,
Superman, which is why I picked it.
Oh, well, that score is very important in what Williams is doing.
Yes, but not
at that
every
point.
Single second is scored in a Superman.
Fair. But this was the way that, you know, movies were... made in the 30s, especially with these, action adventure scores that Ron Williams and Spielberg was kind of going back to with this film. And they ushered in this age of maybe 20, 30 years where, you know, the music was heavily orchestral. I mean, everyone was going back to what Williams did, I think, starting here. And now it's in a way we've kind of come into this period where, especially with summer movies, there is a score, but it's not memorable. It's background music. Yeah. It's a temp track. We're going back to this, like, well, the score is not as important anymore about setting the mood. It's more about the visuals and the effects and things like that. But I actually think I get your point of the third act of this film when it turns into the sea adventure movie. It's interesting. As a kid, that wasn't necessarily my favorite part, but I've now grown to think that is now my favorite part of that movie because it's more of a throwback to the old, old films. And I love John Williams' score even beyond the theme. So I kind of come across that as well. And I also love Quint. Robert Shaw's character, I think, steals the show. So anytime he's on screen,
he is great.
It's just like this
what
movie's so
fascinating,
cool.
Complicated character.
Oh, so amazing. Yeah.
Like, and so many shades are being played. You think he's one thing at a time, but then he's another thing at another time.
Yeah.
That's a pretty great, and I'm glad they put him in because if he were not in, I think that whole third act would be actually quite boring.
Mm-hmm. No. Well, he serves a purpose too. I mean, the movie is a lot about masculinity and you know, maybe that's another topic we can explore at some other point, but you know, it's three kind of aspects of what masculinity, the modern male could represent. And they're all there on that ship. And it's like, who ends up defeating the bad guy? How do they do it? I mean, I think that is a lot of what Spielberg is trying to say here, which I do think this is his best movie, like by far. I think it's Spielberg's masterpiece. I don't think he's ever done anything close to this in my opinion, but definitely I would recommend if you see it, it plays a lot outdoors. Like drive-ins and also just in a movie theater. Like I've seen this film a couple times in the theater, first time in a Spielberg class in college. And it definitely it blows you away even more seeing it on the big screen. So maybe
imagine
the smaller screen might be a difference. And I know you have a really nice large TV, but if you could even get into a theater to see Jaws, I would recommend it.
Yeah, no, I think a lot of this, what I'm saying has to do with how I watched it. So
totally. Yeah,
that's
I get it.
A little bit on me for sure. But in general, I have a thing about sort of quieter moments and breath. Mm-hmm. And I think this movie becomes a lot, you know, scarier, which maybe this is not what they were going for. Mm-hmm. If you sort of have sort of more silent mm-hmm. moments in the movie, but you know, who am I kidding? This is a masterpiece. So
yeah. Cool. great. So coming off of Jaws, what is your number one movie that shaped your summer?
All right, so my number one is The Talented Mr. Ripley from 1999, directed by Anthony Minghella, starring Matt Damon, Gwyneth Paltrow, Jude Law, Cate Blanchett, written by Anthony Minghella himself, but based on a Patricia Highsmith novel. So this is my number one because this movie sort of encapsulates the visual manifestation of summer. It's pleasures, it's decadences, but also this feeling of not fitting in. Mm-hmm. And then the madness that can ensue with the heat and all the pressures and everything that you're feeling, which is sort of my experience with the summer, like I've been hinting throughout this episode. And that's what this movie does. So, you know, on one hand, you're in Europe, beautiful boats, amazing food, sweaty jazz clubs, those lazy mornings in your nice little European cottage or wherever you're living, and you're eating breakfast and you're wearing these summery clothes and you're, you know, driving around Vespas. And I mean, what couldn't be more perfect than that? Like, that is sort of my vision of summer. I hope I get to really do that, where I just take time off and just, I don't know, go to Italy or Bordeaux or somewhere in Europe and just spend time. So that's the fun side of it. But then the other side of it is this feeling of just not belonging, you know? And I think there's something about the summer that heightens that, because your access to wealth and beauty and, you know, what kind of a summer bod you have or you don't have, it does change your experience in terms of how you feel about summer. And if you're not in that club, it can be a trying experience. And there are points in the movie, especially when Matt Damon first arrives in Europe and he's wearing his green swimsuit and he's totally pasty white and everybody makes fun of him and he sort of stands out. I'm not pasty white, but I empathize with that experience of just not fitting in, you know? And there's something about the summer experience that there will always be somebody on the outside. And I've often felt that, because this is a time that calls for, I don't know, a little bit more out of you in terms of having fun and putting yourself out there literally, but also in other ways. And I think that has a lot to do with access to money and wealth and upbringing. And so I think there's a little bit of that that's happening here, or a lot of that that's happening there, I should say. And then, you know, what happens when these feelings of desperation coupled with the heat lead you to madness? And that's sort of what happens with Matt Damon's character, who's a very tragic person, you know, who sort of gets it, but then blows it all away. And you feel for that. And I mean, I have not had that experience. I've not killed anybody, you know, on a boat.
Neither have I. Just, I want to say that too.
Right.
Yep.
Yet. But have I like had like a weird encounter with somebody in the summer where I'm like, it's hot and humid and, you know, it's like one of those off days and I've like yelled at somebody, known or unknown? Yes, for sure. Not proud of it, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But I think there's something about the summer that does bring out, you know, not the nice pieces in me. And so I think there's a little bit of that I see in this movie as well. But me aside, I think this movie is just a gorgeous treat of a movie. It's been in my repeat watch list for a while. I mean, we talk a lot about mise-en-scene. I think this is one of those movies where every department, from costume to set design to score to cinematography, it all comes together with A-list performers at their best. I think this is Matt Damon's best performance. Like, he's truly somebody else, and you sort of see the wheels turning. And I love those performances when you see actors in that, where they're shape-shifting, but not in an obvious way. And we'll get into that a little bit more. But yeah, you're truly transported. The movie drags a little bit in the third act, I will say. I think Cate Blanchett's character, who keeps popping in, I'm like, oh, of course, there you are again. There's a little bit of that always kind of gets on me, but in a teeny way. But otherwise, this movie, I didn't even mention Philip Seymour Hoffman, who's
so good in this.
Oh, amazing in this movie. Terrifying. And you need that sort of, you know, adversary to your crazy lead. So that's so good. But yeah, ultimately, I think this movie is about pretense. Everybody's pretending, not just Ripley. Paul Tro is pretending to be happy in this weird relationship he's in. Jude Law is everything but pretense. Nothing else but pretense, I should say. So is Cate Blanchett. So is everybody, right? So, and I think to bring it back to summer, that's what summer can be. It can be fun, but it can also be a big pretense where suddenly life stops, you're free from your obligations and commitments. And if you can afford it, you can pretend to be in sort of La La Land and, you know, be on your fancy boat and yacht and have a great time. I'm not knocking that. It's pretty great if you can do that.
Yeah.
But there is sort of this veneer of pretense, which I think is on full display in the summer, because you get to go out and so does everybody, you know. In other seasons, you are pretending mostly indoors and only people who are with you can see that. I think the summertime, it's out and loud. And that's what this movie ultimately comes down to. So yeah, that's my number one, Talented Mr. Ripley.
No, interesting. I think the themes and everything you talked about with pretense is definitely like one of the major topics this movie plays around with, and definitely a takeaway, you know, that I have. I associate that for some reason more with a fall than a summer. But this movie does a great job of going through pretense and what the downsides of it, and then how really too, like Ripley's character as well, like he pushes people away because of the pretense that he has. I mean, he starts the movie, he kills somebody who he loved but didn't love him back, which is tragic, but, you know, sad, obviously, because he's driven to kill. But then in the end of the movie, he's actually killing someone who did love him, but he's sort of forced to do that. So it really shows you that he, just to keep up the pretense, he's actually pushing away the one thing that he was craving through the entire movie, which is a real connection to a real person that he didn't have with the person that he murdered the first time. It wasn't reciprocated. And now here's this guy who does reciprocate his love in the way that he would want. But unfortunately now, because of this pretense and this lie that he has to build up throughout the entire film, that's the tragedy of this movie to me. Like, he has to then kill this guy as well, which is just really sad. And, I think performances are great. Jude Law, I mean, this was his star making. I mean, between this and Gattaca, I mean, all of a sudden now it's like
breakout year. Like, Jude Law was everywhere in that.
Oh, yeah.
Couple of year period, to the point that I think he oversaturated.
He did. But it's due to, I mean, you see this and you're like, oh, I want to see more of this guy. And then you realize you don't, but this movie at least makes you excited about seeing a ton of Jude Law. So yeah, I think performances across the board are great. Even Paltrow, who sometimes I think's kind of weak in some films, I think she does a great job here. This had been a movie that I really liked a lot as I saw it in theaters when it came out. So I'd seen it a bunch in high school and college. I haven't actually watched it in maybe like 20 years. So it was nice to kind of come back to it in a weird way. It sort of wasn't as good as I remembered. It felt sort of like very late 90s to me. I can't really put a pin on exactly why, but it felt very dated in the way that it was handling the material. Big literary adaptation, a lot of stars, I can't really articulate it very well, but I watched it like, oh yeah, this movie looks like a late 90s literary adaptation. So it wasn't as good as I remembered, but it still is a great film. And the performance is still, especially Jude Law, still stands out. And you know, that the one famous death scene in the beginning, I guess, or first act, it won't really spoil it for folks that haven't seen the movie, is still shocking, even though you know that it's coming.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, oh my God, like, you know, I've seen it so many times, like I know what's going to happen, but it still is. And that's just the power, I think, of the performances, but also the filmmaking, that they can still lead you in a shocking death like that when you know it's going to happen.
Yeah. I get that about a literary adaptation. I think it's a very mood thing for me. Like, I like The English Patient, but I can't watch it. You know,
that's another example. Yeah, again, it feels right? like that type of it's, there's something that was that, going on in the late 90s.
Yeah, it's in that milieu, which I love the genre, actually.
Yeah.
Please bring these back, honestly, and actually go to those locations and film them and not do Ryan Reynolds green screen situation. Cannot stand anything and everything. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a bit of a mood thing. I think I have to be in the right mood to like watch a movie like this. There are times when I've watched this movie and I've sort of been like, oh, this is dragging a little bit. I'm a little bit bored and what have you. So I think there's a little bit of that. Also, the movie is quite long, you know? So,
it was long, actually. I was definitely feeling like the length a little bit, but I still enjoyed it. It just, surprised at how much it felt dated, I guess. I wasn't expecting that. And dated not in a bad way or a good way, just in a way that I'm like, okay, like you watch this and it makes you understand what was going on in film in the late 90s.
Yeah, because they don't make these movies
in this way. They don't. Yeah, they really don't.
It's actually sad, you know, like it was such a long time. And we've talked about this on this podcast, like celebrated novels were the IP for mm-hmm. a long time. That was happening in the 30s and 40s. Like people, it was an event. Who's going to mm-hmm. be in the Gone with the Wind?
Exactly.
Blah, blah, blah. You know, now our IP is what we know what our IP is. So, I mean, I would be very excited if we kind of made some space
for
this IP as well, that because people actually don't read anymore. So I don't know if that's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think it could also be more towards like the dynamics of the business in the sense of the reason why a lot of our IP are things like Marvel, DC, Star Wars, because the companies own that IP outright and they don't have to pay for the use of Superman. Well, that was a bad example. They kind of do for that estate a little bit, but you make an Iron Man movie, you're just making an Iron Man movie, no cost. You have to now adapt Da Vinci Code. You're paying Dan Brown a ton of money. So if I was a studio, you know what? Why are we adapting things that we don't own? And I think that is maybe why, one reason why we're seeing a lot less of that, because they have to pay up front for the rights of something. It's easier just to pull out of their vault something they already own to just save money, because it's all about the bean counters nowadays. But I do wish that it's some way this could come back in some form too, because I think it's an important genre for film.
All right. I guess this is our list. Were there any that didn't make your list, Alex?
Yeah, there are a couple. A couple other the summer movies, like I mentioned, Con Air, Independence Day, Godzilla, Pirates of the Caribbean, National Lampoon's Summer Vacation, going on that vacation theme, Wet Hot American Summer, and Heavyweights, a movie about summer camp, which I never went to, but I think if I did go, that's how I imagined it would be. But those are my films. What about you?
That's a good one. I was thinking of Call Me By Your Name, several other obvious summer blockbuster movies as well, Wet Hot American Summer, a bunch of John Hughes movies, because I feel like a lot of teenage movies are actually during that time. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. All right. So that was our episode. We hope you enjoyed our summer movies. Please listen to us, like us, subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts. Until next time. Bye.
Bye, everyone. Enjoy your summer.